This episode is brought to you by VPP Simplified. Now you can get element by element tracking and guidance for your VPP journey. Every aspect of the VPP requirements in one easy to use interactive spreadsheet. It explains every sub element in detail, contains an easy to read stoplight so you can track current status for each sub element. It provides you with a three-step verification for completion of each sub-element. There's even a notes section for you to compile language that will eventually be used for your VPP application. It even comes complete with graphs to show current state and track your progress moving forward. Look, achieving VPP star status can be tough, but understanding what it takes to get there can be simplified. This VPP gap tool will help you do that. Go to vppsimplified.com for more information.
Welcome to the Safety Pro Podcast, where we help you manage workplace safety one episode at a time. And now, your very own safety pro, Blaine J. Hoffman.
Welcome to another episode of the Safety Pro Podcast. This is the final in a series on confined spaces, part three. I'm going to wrap it up talking about confined spaces. I'm sure we'll revisit this in the future at some point, but for this series, part three, I want to talk about safety training for rescue teams. I want to talk about first aid, all that good stuff. So in the last couple of episodes, I sort of danced around the rescue team parts of the standard. And again, I wanted to dedicate an entire episode to that. So let's start with an outside rescue option, since a lot of folks go with this route. Now, if you recall, whenever you use an outside resource, you must evaluate their ability to respond to rescue summons in a timely manner. And again, this is all considering the hazards that you have identified. So it's obvious that you have to have done a hazard assessment first, so that you can have a meaningful conversation with this outside agency. Also, don't forget, bring them in, do a walkthrough, look at the spaces involved, the internal configurations, chemicals used on site, things like that. Along those lines, you also have to develop and implement procedures for summoning the rescue services to your location. So you have to work with them about the site layout, the best ways to enter the facility if it's a fixed plant, or it's a large plant geographically separated by, you know, some local communities or other surface roads. It's not a contiguous facility. So you have to go over all that stuff. The best way to summon rescue services to your site. You're going to need to work with them. You're going to have, you know, work with them on numbering your entries and gates going into your facility. Your emergency exit doors should be numbered. Your bay doors, dock doors. Somebody should know, you know, as a former firefighter myself, it was really helpful for somebody to say the southwest entrance gate number 8, and then it was labeled and marked. And we'd go in through that gate and say, come through door number 4, in the backside of the, you know, south side of the building. And we knew exactly, if we'd have maps, we knew exactly where we were going. Also, ask about whether your local authorities use a regional dispatcher versus an in-house dispatch that goes direct to fire and EMS. You know, this could delay response time a little bit, and that's just something you're going to have to know. Find out if there is another number to use to call directly in to emergencies, if that will help. May not be applicable in all jurisdictions, but something to ask. Once you determine the rescue team will be used, you have to develop a procedure for actually rescuing entrants from the spaces that you have. And you have to be able to provide necessary emergency services to those workers that are making entries. So it's a good idea when you have, you know, once you determine they're capable, the local authorities or rescue team is capable of making it a rescue, then you want to have some training or expose some site workers to the procedures that will take place during rescue. You then have to make a determination as to whether or not you're going to have first aid responders at your facility. The primary requirement in the first aid standards is that you have to ensure prompt first aid treatment for injured employees, either providing for the availability of a trained first aid personnel at the worksite or ensuring emergency treatment is available within reasonable proximity of the worksite. So you have to take appropriate steps prior to any accident, like making arrangements with this rescue provider, to determine if the medical assistance will be prompt. Now, if you recall from the previous episodes, I'm going to repeat it here. The standards do not prescribe a number of minutes to define this. OSHA has long interpreted the term, quote, near proximity to mean that emergency care has to be available within no more than 3 to 4 minutes from the workplace. There's been an interpretation that's actually been upheld by OSHA, the review commission, and by federal courts on this one. So don't try to find any wiggle room here. Just know that it's 3 to 4 minutes. If that response time cannot be met, you have to provide on-site trained first aid responders. So that's one of your options. Provide these workers with first aid CPR training. This option is feasible for most employers. It's low cost. It's a great way to protect employees as well as getting you in compliance with these standards. Now, OSHA recommends but does not require that every workplace include one or more employees who are trained in certified first aid and CPR. The first aid training standards are found at 29 CFR 1910.151, and in construction, it's 1926.50C. Those would generally apply throughout the industries that they cover. Now, there are other standards that apply to certain specific hazards or industries, and they make employee first aid training actually mandatory, and reliance on an outside emergency responder is not allowed. And again, those are very specific. So here's an example, 1910.266, it's I-7. That's mandatory first aid training for logging employees, and 29 CFR 1910.269B that requires persons trained in first aid at work locations in electric power industry. You don't have an option to rely on an outside rescue service. You have to have, it's mandatory that you have first aid CPR training on site. So I would go ahead and take that approach. Do we have an opportunity to improve the way we respond to emergencies by having some people trained in first aid CPR? Look at your emergency procedures, your written program for handling emergencies. This is also a great place to stop and talk about one of our awesome partners in safety that can help with a very important aspect in dealing with an emergency at your site, and that is evacuation management. We all know safety and security starts with knowing who is on site. That's why you need to know who's on location. Who'sonlocation.com handles visitor management, contractor management, employee attendance, and evacuation management. Who's on Location's evacuation management helps you get your people safe, give first responders critical information about who cannot be accounted for, all before they put their lives at risk. Who's on Location's evacuation management is available for iOS, both iPhone and iPad, Microsoft, both phone and Surface, and Android, both phone and tablet, as a web application. You can roll call employees, visitors, and contractors. They then swipe their name from the present on site list when they are safe using that web app. You can send everyone on site a request via text to confirm they're in a safe location in just a few clicks. When they reply with the word safe, they are automatically removed from the list of people you still need to verify. And, this is a great feature, if someone replies with anything other than the word safe, it is relayed to all app users in case someone is nearby and can safely render assistance. Check it out for yourself. You won't be disappointed. Get a 30-day free trial by going to whosonlocation.com. You get access to all the features and add-ons. No credit card required. Again, go to whosonlocation.com for a free 30-day trial today. Another incredible safety partner that can help you with locating and marking all of your confined spaces is the official floor marking company of the Safety Pro podcast, Mighty Line Floor Tape. Now, they know how important safety is to your organization, and the breadth of the Mighty Line product line covers everything you need to implement a 5S system for the increased productivity of your facility and the safety of your workers. Mighty Line floor signs are a great product to not only regulate workplace traffic, but to identify hazards like confined spaces at your facility. These signs are customizable. You can even use your own high-res logos, and they fit exactly what your company needs. Their floor tape is world-class. Just listen to some of these facts. Mighty Line floor tape is 7 times thicker than the average floor tape. Their patented technology makes it more durable. The beveled edge increases durability during forklift traffic. The peel and stick adhesive removes easily, and it's all made right here in the USA. Get a free sample of Mighty Line floor tape. Go to mightylinetape.com/podcast. Fill out the form, get a free sample sent directly to you. You can even catch past episodes of the Safety Pro podcast right there on their page. Again, mightylinetape.com/podcast. Okay, so seriously look at getting a team of volunteers to be trained on all shifts. And if you needed more support for this approach, medical literature establishes that for serious injuries, such as those involving stopped breathing, cardiac arrest, uncontrolled bleeding, first aid treatment must be provided within the first few minutes to avoid permanent medical impairment or death. Also, in workplaces where serious accidents, such as those involving falls, suffocation, electrocution, or amputation are possible, emergency medical services must be available within 3 to 4 minutes. If there is no employee on site who is trained to render first aid. So we're going back to this whole, the general requirement that OSHA sets for requiring, and you know, in the absence of an infirmary or clinic and access to within a reasonable amount of time, emergency services, you have to provide somebody on site. Now, OSHA does exercise some discretion when enforcing the first aid requirements in some cases. They recognize that a somewhat longer response time of up to about 15 minutes may be reasonable in the workplace, like an office, where the possibility of serious work-related injuries are remote. And I've said this before. So keep that in mind. If you're not dealing with some of these serious debilitating injuries and industrial type of hazards, OSHA does sort of allow a little bit more time for response because the likelihood of a serious debilitating injury or life-threatening event is more remote. Now remember, it's worth repeating, in the absence of an infirmary, clinic, or hospital in near proximity to the workplace, which is used for the treatment of all injured workers, a person or persons shall be adequately trained to render first aid. Adequate first aid supplies shall be readily available, and having first aid kits and volunteers trained in first aid and CPR, it's a great way to meet the standard. And for an in-house rescue team, at least one member of the rescue team or service has to hold a current certification in first aid and CPR, and they have to be available. It's kind of baked into the confined space standard that if you're going to use an in-house rescue team, even non-entry rescue or an outside rescue service, at least one, I'm shocked that they only have one, right? At least one member of that team has to be available. So all shifts, at all times, anytime an entry is being made. So trust me, all of the members should have this training. I mean, think about it. What if the only member that's trained in first aid and CPR goes down, gets injured, gets taken out of the equation somehow? What are you going to do? So spread the love, folks. Everybody on the team should have first aid, basic first aid CPR, and trained in the hazards likely they're likely to encounter. That's another key aspect of the training. So this tells us we need to carefully examine and consider the actual hazards likely to be present, as well as the injuries and illnesses likely to occur. This has to be included in the training in order for us to claim that our in-house first aid team is, quote, adequate. See, OSHA uses that term, adequately trained, right? So let me illustrate this for you. I've reviewed in the past as an emergency response trainer. I trained emergency responders, firefighters, police officers, professional rescuer trainer for the Red Cross, and I've reviewed lots of training programs. Most of the basic first aid CPRs, they cover what to do, how to react, things like that, you know, how to keep calm. A lot of effort goes into keeping the responder safe, you know, the bloodborne pathogens training, PPE, sizing up the scene or checking the scene to make sure it's safe. And that's all great. You need to have that. That should be a part of every training program. And then there are sections that get into how to perform a patient survey, you know, conscious and unconscious patient, sections for covering how to stop bleeding and immobilizing a limb, maybe wrapping and bandaging, and some basic first aid. Here's where you need to be sure to include covering injuries likely to occur at your facility. So you work with your instructor ahead of time to include how to treat, a chemical burn. And you have to, and you should probably be specific. Hydrochloric acid, chlorine gas, for example, if that's what's at your site. This site-specific or chemical or hazard-specific training is what will deem your personnel qualified to render first aid at your facility. The basic community first aid training that you go down to the Y and get, it's great. It's fantastic. Everybody should get that. Statistically, you're going to use this training outside of work before you probably are likely to use it at work, okay? But the community first aid CPR is just not adequate enough for many of the industrial hazards and substances that you're going to be exposed to. So you have to include those portions. You have to work with your instructor. Don't go just buy the book and do the community first aid CPR. This is how you wrap gauze around a forearm that has a laceration. You know, that's great, but how do we treat a chemical burn? How do we use the eye wash and shower effectively? Drag the safety data sheets out and cover the first aid treatment requirements for exposure to certain chemicals when it says remove to fresh air and, you know, rinse for 15 minutes. Practice where you're going to stage these operations and how you're going to get somebody out when you make your rescue and it says remove to fresh air. You know, what's the best way to get them out of the building based on where that location is in your facility, that's confined space and where that chemical is being used. These are all things that are going to deem your responders adequate. Okay, so let's move on to focusing on an in-house rescue team. First, OSHA says they have to be equipped for and proficient in performing the needed rescue services. Do you have underground tanks? Do they have, or spaces, right? Do they have, I'm just kind of spitballing here. Do they have rectangular openings? Entry points? Are they square? Are they round? Or is it a combination, right? And the reason why I'm asking this is going to tell me the types of hoists and retrieval, you know, davit arms, tripods. That's going to tell me the types of equipment I'm going to need to have available to facilitate these rescues, to not just protect entrance with the standard fall protection type of equipment, but to be able to pull somebody out in an emergency situation, that one size does not fit all. So you have to kind of know what types of spaces you're dealing with, and that's going to drive the equipment you have, and that's going to get us to, are we equipped? So some of your spaces, they could be above grade, requiring staging from an elevated platform, could be horizontal spaces. Again, this is going to tell me, do we need aerial lifts, personnel lifts, stair chairs, Stokes baskets, all this stuff we're going to need to facilitate a rescue from an elevated space. What about SCBAs, right? Self-contained breathing apparatus. What about airline respirators? This is getting a little more involved in the entry rescue portion when, you know, non-entry rescue is what you want to achieve. You want to shoot for non-entry rescue and let local authorities, hopefully if you have them nearby, facilitate entry rescues. So I won't get in too much into the entry rescue portion where you have to provide a breathing atmosphere for your rescuers and get into the respiratory protection standard, the pulmonary function tests and physicals and the fit testing and all of that. That actually is going to make for a great podcast episode, getting into the respiratory protection standard. But I will focus on, for the rest of this episode, non-entry rescue. Okay, so equipped means just that, the equipment needed to facilitate a rescue from any and all possible spaces to be entered. So standardization really helps, but many older facilities that have been upgraded and modified over the years don't have this luxury. But think about this moving forward, standardizing, you know, openings, both their shape and size, whenever possible, and their location, at grade versus elevated openings, things like that. This all has to be set up and gone over each time you have training for your team. Every piece of equipment has to be set up, drug out. Doesn't matter if you have 12 different types of configuration of tripods and davit arms and retrieval lines. Every one of them has to be reviewed, set up, and practiced, right? Every piece, all the PPE that may be needed, all of the monitoring instruments that you have, everything. So you could see clearly how this could be a chore, right? Both administratively and in time. So, you know, I've seen this in my past. This explains a lot of, you know, why we would find some holes in training programs, because, you know, the business just looks at the time needed every year to go through all of this. So finding unique ways to, streamline this process and go through and do like you do lockout, tagout, hands-on verification. Again, another great podcast episode topic. But as an example, when somebody is actually going through a lockout, tagout process and applying lockout, tagout on a particular process, it's a good time to do a review, an observation and evaluation of that. So if a team is setting up for a space entry and some maintenance is taking place and you have the rescue team on standby, it's a great time to set that space up, get the tripod out, simulate if you have a dummy, or you could even simulate hoisting if it's safe to do so, an actual person out of the space when the work is done. It's a great way to, since it's all out there and set up, it's a great way to just certify that, you know, check that box that, you know, we've practiced a simulated rescue and it has to be done I'm going to get into this here in a minute, but that's another way you can look at streamlining this training process. The downside to that is you have to wait until maintenance takes place. If you've got scheduled PMs, it's good to look at a schedule and just sort of look at a 12-month calendar, rolling calendar, and say, yeah, we're going to hit every piece of equipment in our confined space entry rescue inventory in this 12-month span based on the PM work that is scheduled. The trick is making sure that every rescue personnel is able to do this, to go through this. So there's a downside logistically, but it's a great way to streamline it is to take advantage of the opportunity when the work presents itself, right? So sticking with that, you know, how often do we have to do this? You have to ensure that rescue and other affected employees, like potential victims, practice making permit space rescues at least every 12 months. This has to be by way of a simulated rescue, in which, as I said, you remove dummies, mannequins, or an actual person, if it's safe, from the actual permit spaces, or, this is key, from representative permit spaces. So the representative space has to, like with respect to size, opening, configuration, accessibility, it has to simulate the types of spaces from which actual rescue is to be performed. I have seen a few facilities that they've replaced an underground storage tank and they've kept the old one, cleaned it up, painted it, and they've cut the sides out. So it's basically a honeycomb, you know, shape. It's all ventilated. It's not even really a confined space anymore. But so structurally, it's maintained its integrity, but they've opened up the ends and cut out big, huge windows in the sides. And they use that to still practice entry and retrieval and rescue. Again, it's a luxury if you can afford it. If you have the real estate, a lot of folks have some catch basins that they concrete catch basins they've purchased with some manholes, manhole sections, and they simulate rescues. Of course, non-entry rescue, as I stated before, is where it's at whenever possible. That's where you want to be. If your rescue personnel never have to enter, then that is the best scenario. Remember, more than half of confined space fatalities are would-be rescuers. You know, train and equip to prevent them from having to go in That is the best scenario. To facilitate non-entry rescue, retrieval systems or methods have to be used whenever an authorized entrant enters a space, unless that retrieval equipment would increase the overall risk of entry or would not contribute to the rescue of an entrant. So, I get this question a lot. How do we use a hoist and winch with a horizontal space? Well, it depends. If you go into a horizontal space and there's pipes and encumbrances that, you know, you start hoisting this person out horizontally and they get caught on pipes and valves, you end up breaking their neck, arms, legs, or they just get hung up. It's not going to facilitate rescuing them. Then you don't use it. You have to use another method, which is probably going to get you into an entry rescue. So you have to evaluate your spaces. You have to determine what's the most feasible, the safest way, practical way to facilitate a rescue. So again, practicing at least every 12 months is the OSHA standard. Again, I recommend more frequently than that. Certainly with the first aid CPR folks, if you get people to volunteer on all shifts to be a part of the first aid first responder team, they have to practice this too. I've gone to facilities where they'll have maintenance making entry and they're trained. The maintenance folks are trained on the actual retrieval equipment and they practice this. And then I ask, hey, you know, how many of your maintenance personnel are trained in first aid CPR? Only a few. We have first responders in the area though, and of the, you know, every plant, all shifts. Okay, where are they? Why aren't they practicing with this equipment? So a lot of them go with this, well, we use the maintenance personnel to hoist the people out, and then we have a first responder standing there. Cross-train. You never know in an emergency when something is going to happen. You know, maintenance personnel, a small maintenance team of three or four people, they're tight-knit group. You know, they care for one another. Statistically, you know what happens. Somebody's going to go in and try to facilitate a rescue. Something's going to happen. Again, more than half of victims of related fatalities are would-be rescuers. More than half. So if you have first aid CPR trained folks at your facility that are going to be called to that site, that location, that entry point to help render first aid, you better train them on the use of that retrieval equipment, the non-entry equipment as well. The first aid responders should be trained on the typical hazards that you would encounter in a confined space. They work there, so they're going to be familiar with the facilities, the processes, and the layout. Go over the hazards that entrants would encounter, the signs and symptoms of exposure, just like you would have to train as I talked in our previous episode, you would have to train entrants, attendants, and supervisors, you know, for the entry. So train these first aid responders. I personally don't think 12 months recertifying your first aid and every 2 years recertifying your CPR, that's just not enough. So if you can, I would hold monthly first responder meetings instead of that annual refresher. So, and the reason is because this is a perishable skill. This is a use it or lose it skill, okay? Again, statistically, they're not likely to use this training at work, more so outside of the home, especially with kids and family. So give your responders a chance to talk about scenarios that have occurred, practice first aid techniques in the meetings, do some dry runs, even debrief runs that they actually had in the past month, which, you know, what things could go better, what didn't go right, things like that. That could add value and enhance that bare minimum that OSHA sets for this stuff. Look at your training program. What is it missing? What don't you cover that we just ran through? Can you enhance your existing training with any of the stuff that we just talked about? You know, well, how can you make it stick? This is the challenge I have for you. Do a full review of your written confined space entry program, the written permit, the rescue plan, your training process, your chosen method of rescue, you know, non-entry, in-house, or outside rescue team. Try to poke holes in your plans so that you can improve it. When was the last time you had the outside agency out? You know, forget confined space. Just do this in general. You're a manufacturing facility. When was the last time you had the local authorities come out, the rescue service come out and do a walkthrough. I think I mentioned this in a previous episode on confined spaces as well. That's my challenge. Let me know how it goes. Let me know if you found opportunities to improve or if you found major gaps in your programs or plans. Share that with me. Let me know. The email link in the show notes, that's the best way to shoot me a message. You can also go to thesafetypropodcast.com and you can get a hold of me there. I do have samples for you in the show notes, the links also on thesafetypropodcast.com. Go to this episode's page and you will find links to a written plan. I have a template for an actual confined space written plan, a permit template, and even a checklist to help you evaluate confined spaces at your site. Remember, go to thesafetypropodcast.com, go to episodes, find this episode, and you'll have all the information you need right there. If you're on a mobile device, you can click the links in the show notes on your mobile device, fill out the email form there, and get an email sent to you. Don't worry, don't spam. I don't like spam at all. I don't share your email with anybody, but it's a great way to get that free download sent directly to your inbox and get started evaluating your written programs right away. Don't forget, visit our partners in safety, whosonlocation.com. Get a 30-day risk-free trial of all of their apps. Again, whosonlocation.com. And the official floor marking sign. And of course, the official floor marking company of the Safety Pro Podcast, Mighty Line Floor Tape. Grab your free sample today. Go to mightylinetape.com/podcast. Check out past episodes of the podcast as well on that page. Again, mightylinetape.com/podcast. And until the next Safety Pro podcast episode, please be safe.